History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The experience of Japanese Americans in World War II is almost exclusively understood through their time spent in internment camps. Now, this is, of course, a chapter of American history that shouldn't be forgotten. But for tens of thousands of Japanese Americans, their most important experience during World War II was actually fighting Nazis. The 442nd Infantry Regiment was a regiment of the U.S. Army that was best known as a fighting unit composed almost entirely of second-generation American soldiers of Japanese ancestry. They fought in Italy, southern France, and Germany, and the unit was organized in 1943 in response to the War Department's call for volunteers to form the segregated Japanese-American Combat Unit. Over 12,000 Japanese-American volunteers answered the call, even though many of these soldiers still had families in internment camps while they fought abroad. To discuss this unit, today's guest is Daniel James Brown, author of the book The Boys in the Boat. He's the author of the new book Facing the Mountain that looks at the stories of four young men who overcame brutal odds in Europe. And they came from across the continental U.S. and Hawaii, and their parents taught them to embrace both their Japanese heritage and the ways of their American homeland. They believed in bright futures as American citizens, but within days of Pearl Harbor, the FBI was ransacking their houses and locking up their fathers. Within months, many themselves would be living behind barbed wire. To learn their stories, both in the United States and abroad fighting in Europe, Brown interviewed the families of the four protagonists of his book, and delves into the story of how they were asked on the front lines in Europe to do the near impossible and often suicidal missions. So this is an unexpected story of World War II, but I think one worth remembering. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Daniel James Brown. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Your book covers the experiences of Japanese Americans during World War II, although at an angle that most popular history doesn't cover, and we'll get into that. But to start off at the 30,000-foot view, here's something I'm curious about. There have been many groups in American history that were part of American life, but almost lived their own parallel existence. You could go back to Catholics in the colonial period, or Irish immigrants who came in the 1840s, or Black free men who lived in the North in the antebellum period, or Jews who came from the Russian Empire after the pogroms in the 1880s, or Armenians who came to California from the Ottoman Empire in the 1890s. From what you saw as you started to research the experience of Japanese Americans during, right before and during World War II, were there parts of their experience that you think was universal that these immigrant groups faced and also unique that they faced?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the first generation of Japanese immigrants, mostly to Hawaii and the West Coast, the Issei first generation, well, first of all, they were not allowed by law to become U.S. citizens. So they were not able even to aspire to citizenship. So they were marginalized as other immigrant groups have been and tended often to live within their own communities. Their children, their American-born children, the Nisei, on the other hand, very much strove to fit into American society, grew up pretty much, depending on their economic circumstances, as any other Americans did during that era. But both the Issei and the Nisei were subject to relentless discrimination, to various forms of exclusion from public facilities. They were demonized in the press, particularly during what the period called the Yellow Peril in the early 20th century, late 19th century. So they found themselves demonized and characterized in very, very derogatory terms right from the time they first showed up. And I should say this fits in a larger context of Asian American immigrants to the United States, beginning primarily with Chinese who came to the West Coast to work in the gold fields in the 1850s. And then a great deal of violence and hatred was directed towards the Chinese immigrants. And as Japanese immigrants began to come later, the same thing pretty much happened to them.
What you write about in your book, it's both the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, but also how tens of thousands of them had combat experience. Starting off, what piqued your interest in this topic in general, the internment, but also in particular, the warfighting experience that many had?
Yeah. So what happened was I met a gentleman named Tom Ikeda in Seattle, and Tom has spent the last 25 years collecting oral histories, videotaped oral histories of Japanese Americans, mostly Meisei, the second generation. And he's assembled all these oral histories, these videotapes in a publicly accessible site called Densho. I met Tom and talked to him, and then I dove into the Densho archives. And I was just absolutely fascinated by the stories. There are so many amazing stories of people both overcoming great obstacles when they immigrated to the United States, and then the obstacles that their children faced growing up, the incarcerations in the camps. And then what was more or less news to me was these young Meisei men who volunteered for the U.S. Army after Pearl Harbor and wound up fighting incredibly bravely in Europe in 1944 and 1945. And some of these stories were just absolutely arrested my attention. So the book really grew out of my working with Tom, trying to find a handful of stories that taken together would tell the larger story of what that generation of Japanese Americans went through and what they accomplished.
Well, like you do with your previous book, Boys in the Boat, you're looking at a large story, but you're also focusing through the experiences of a few people. And in particular, you look at four men and their experience. But before getting into what they went to in World War II, could you describe how drastically their lives changed before and after Pearl Harbor? And for listeners who want to get into this more, I had a guest who wrote a book called Panic on the Pacific on how a terror just swept through the West Coast right after Pearl Harbor. And people thought that an invasion was coming to them next. And without stealing your thunder too much, how did their lives and their families' lives change immediately after Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, it was an extraordinary, traumatic event. You know, we all believe we know the Pearl Harbor story, and we do. We've all seen the films and read about it, of course. But part of what I wanted my readers to do was to see that event through the eyes of Japanese Americans. And it's the same event, but it's seen through a somewhat different lens. And if anything, I think Japanese Americans experienced even more shock and trauma after Pearl Harbor than other Americans did. The whole country was traumatized. But Japanese Americans, particularly second generation American-born Nisei, they realized immediately that they were going to be equated with the enemy. And so that in itself was shocking and horrific to them. And so what unfolded in the weeks and months after Pearl Harbor, of course, was this huge upsurge in anti-Asian, anti-Japanese feeling, rhetoric, and in some cases, violence that culminated, you know, a couple months later with the rounding up and the incarceration of over 100,000 people on the West Coast in these camps. And you know, it's hard to overstate how extremely painful that was. People had to leave their businesses. People had to leave their schools. People had to leave, children had to leave beloved pets behind. Businesses lost their customers. They lost their customer base. They lost their real estate. They lost their inventory. It was an absolutely devastating blow to this community, particularly. There was also a large Japanese American community in Hawaii, but particularly on the West Coast of the mainland. Was an absolutely devastating blow to them.
Right. And an interesting thing I learned, I'm doing a military history of World War II in the Pacific Theater with a co-host. And in terms of those who were interned, the numbers were far higher in California than they were in Hawaii, which is strange because if you think that the native population really is a hotbed of sedition, they would be far more of a threat in Hawaii than they would in California, where there's no way the Japanese could extend their logistics network. So,
I'm sorry, you would think so. The right. problem was, from the military's point of view, Hawaii's population was somewhere between 30 and 40% Japanese American. And so it was simply impossible to incarcerate all the Japanese and Japanese Americans in Hawaii without completely shutting down the economy of Hawaii. And of course, Hawaii needed to function because it was the base from which the Pacific War would be fought.
Right. And I think I've read a few accounts that Roosevelt heard diplomatic chatter that Imperial Japan was trying to infiltrate the Japanese American population, as any good nation state would try to do espionage. But I think there was far more German activity among German Americans, and there were plenty of German Americans, but there wasn't an internment camp there. And years ago, The Onion had an article that 30 million German Americans sent to internment camp during World War II, that because it was so, from looking at it completely logically, they would be the equal threat, but because you couldn't do anything, they were just written off. So But getting back into the thrust of your book, can you tell me the stories? You look at four men in particular and their families. Could you touch on briefly, once they and their families are put into internment camps, where do they go from there?
Yeah, so it depended on where they were from. As you pointed out, people from Hawaii were not put in the camps at all, except that there were a number of first-generation Japanese immigrants that were put on a list by the FBI as being suspicious, which actually turned out to be entirely bogus. But the mainland Japanese Americans, first of all, not everybody was incarcerated, only those who lived along the West Coast itself. So there was an exclusion zone. And if you lived east, for instance, in Washington State of the Columbia River, you were not incarcerated. But they were rounded up. They were put in first in a series of assembly centers, which were usually fairgrounds and racetracks up and down the West Coast. And so people were housed in horse stalls and in all kinds of, you know, pretty atrocious conditions. For a few months, while the government set about to building permanent camps, the camps themselves were in the bleakest places you can imagine in the American West. So one of the guys I follow in the book, Rudy Tokiwa, he grew up in Salinas, California. His family was first in an assembly center at the Rodeo Grounds in Salinas, and then transported to Poston, Arizona, which is out in the Mojave Desert. Absolutely bleak, horrible place, particularly, of course, in the summer. And it was while he was in that camp that Rudy volunteered to join the Army. So these camps were up and down the West Coast, always in particularly unpleasant places. And that's where the vast majority of 100,000 Japanese Americans spent the war years.
A lot of what your book focuses on is the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. This was a combat team mostly of Japanese Americans who fight different places in the European theater. Three of the people in your book fight for it, even as for some of them, their family is still interned. How do they get involved?
So that was it was a big debate within the camps. These young men like Rudy, for instance, they weren't certain when they were first, they were not allowed to join the Army, but when they were made eligible to join the Army, there was a large debate amongst them. Many of these young men felt that no way were they going to serve the government that had incarcerated their families who were still incarcerated. They wanted nothing to do with it. But another group of these young men felt that, well, the best way to prove that we are Americans and that we deserve the respect that's due to other Americans is to join the war effort and fight. And so a lot of the 442nd was composed from young men who came out of these camps as volunteers. The slightly larger group actually was Japanese Americans living in Hawaii, where there was a somewhat different dynamic. Their families had not been incarcerated unless they happened to have relatives living on the West Coast. But there was a great desire amongst a lot of these young men to contribute to the war effort. They had, many of them had witnessed Pearl Harbor, you know, those living on Oahu had witnessed Pearl Harbor themselves. And they wanted, like other young American men, they wanted in on the war. So they joined from Hawaii in very large numbers. And then, as I say, a certain number came out of the camps on the West Coast.
The 442nd, it's formed in 1943, where the War Department calls for volunteers to form segregated Japanese American Army combat unit. What's interesting is you'd think that they would be more useful in the Pacific theater, let's say intelligence or translation, since we broke the Japanese code pretty early on in the war. So overall, what is the military's strategy with the 442nd in the European theater?
Yeah. So, well, actually, there was a separate thing. There was the military, the MIS, the Military Intelligence Service, did wind up recruiting hundreds of Japanese Americans who were fluent in Japanese to do, just as you suggest, to work in intelligence. So most of them, many of them were in the Navy on ships, decoding or translating documents and radio transmissions. But the much larger group was the 442nd. And I think there was a deliberate decision to send them to Europe rather than to the war in the Pacific, partly because there was a lot of fear of what would happen to them if they were captured by Japanese imperial troops. So the decision was to send them, after basic training in Mississippi, to Europe. And that's where they saw the great, you know, bulk of the of their war experience.
Without giving away too much in your book, what were notable events that happened among the men that you profile in your book with their time in the 442nd?
Yeah. So the 442nd landed at Anzio in Italy, just as the Americans were breaking out of the beachhead at Anzio and advancing up through Rome. So they fought their way over the next several months. They fought their way up the Italian boot, fighting, almost always fighting uphill, one hilltop town after another. The Germans always had the high ground in Italy. And they had to fight, they fought along the western side of Italy, up through Tuscany, through absolutely gorgeous countryside. But they fought a series of pitched battles, some of which were absolutely horrific in terms of casualties. And pretty much mile by mile, they clawed back that part of Italy from the Germans until they reached Livorno and the Arno River. And then they were sent to France, northern France, where the Allies were beginning to push the Germans back towards the German border. And really the apex of the book, the battlefield part of the book, really happens there in France in the Vosges Forest. They were given the task of liberating a little town called Bruyère in France. And they did that after a particularly bloody battle. But then they were sent up a mountainside to rescue a battalion of soldiers, mostly from Texas, Texas Division, who had gotten stranded and surrounded and trapped at the end of a ridgeline up in the Vosges Mountains. And I won't give away too much here. But that battle, trying to reach the Texans, trying to rescue the Texans, was absolutely horrific for all involved. One of the guys I followed were all in K Company. I think of the 200 or so that were standing at the beginning of the battle for Bruyère, I think when they finally came down after out of the mountains, only 17 of them were still walking. The rest had all been injured or killed. So an absolutely amazing, heroic, uphill battle in the Vosges Mountains. Then they were sent back to Italy, and they were given the task of breaking through the western end of the Gothic line, this series of fortifications that the Germans had built. And once again, they found themselves in the mountains fighting uphill, again against enormous odds. And then the last sort of stage of the military part of the story is some of them were sent back to the French-German border as the German army pretty much collapsed and found themselves racing through southern Bavaria, chasing the Germans. And as they did that, they came across the Dachau concentration camp, actually a series of camps spread around Dachau. And there they participated in the liberation of some of the Dachau prisoners, not from the main camp, but from some of the satellite camps of Dachau.
I wonder, how are they received by Europeans? Because all Europeans would have understood that the Japanese Empire was part of the Axis Alliance. And here you have a regiment of ethnic Japanese troops, but they're fighting with the Allies and they're Americans. Did you see any accounts of Europeans saying, wait, what's going on here?
Yes, absolutely. It happened quite a bit. Europeans had a very hard time understanding what they were seeing when they saw GIs with Japanese faces coming to their towns. Some of them literally thought the Japanese had gone over and joined the Allies in the invasion of Germany. Some of them assumed these guys were Chinese or some other ethnicity. But there were a series of pretty amusing incidents where 442nd soldiers wound up having to try to explain that, yes, indeed, they really were Americans.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That'd be probably pretty tiring after a while, but yeah. It happens. There's another person I would love for you to discuss. And then after you discuss him, I'd love to get into the maybe a larger philosophical look at when you're fighting on behalf of a nation that doesn't give you full rights compared to other people, what does that mean of fighting to improve things versus being a conscientious objector? And one of the figures in your book, one of the men, is Gordon Hirabayashi, who was a resistor. He didn't join the military. So why do you think it's important to share his story? Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Well, I wanted to share Gordon's story because, first of all, it reflects the reality. As I say, particularly among the young men in the camps, there were those who decided they should join. There were also those who decided very strongly on principle that they should not join the military. And so it's the reality. It was a difficult decision. It was a really hard place they were put in to have to try to figure out whether they should do that under the circumstances they found themselves in. So Gordon's a really interesting guy. And I picked him partly because his personal story was particularly interesting. He wrote a lot about his experiences. He was very articulate, and he left a lot of recordings afterwards of why he had done what he did. But Gordon refused to get on the bus to go to the assembly center. He was a student at the University of Washington in Seattle. And when the time came for the Japanese Americans in Seattle to get on the bus and go to the assembly center in Puyallup, he simply didn't show up. Instead, he went down to the FBI office and turned himself in. He knew that he was going to suffer consequences for this. He didn't want to get his friends and supporters in trouble. So he took it upon himself to turn himself in to the FBI. And then from that point forward, he wound up in the King County Jail. And there's a whole series of things that Gordon went through. But I think readers are really going to enjoy getting to know Gordon because he was such an interesting guy. And the stand he took was so carefully thought out and so principled.
And you're right. And this is something that's always been a part of American history is the conscientious objector. You could look at populations like Mennonites who out of religious principle wouldn't join a war effort. And you could find plenty of other populations that would have that same thing. Jumping up to the 30,000 foot view, I have a question about being involved in a war effort when you're part of a group that is, let's say, second class versus being a conscientious objector. And something that has happened frequently in American history is that there have been groups that performed valiantly in war, and many historians would argue it expanded the rights of those groups, like the 54th Massachusetts Infantry Regiment, the Black Regiment in the Civil War. The movie Glory is based on them, or the Tuskegee Airmen in World War II. They performed equally as well as their white counterparts. And many argue that the Tuskegee Airmen is what led to the desegregation of the military in 1948. So World War II is sort of the high point of, I guess, civic nationalism, where groups that even though they don't have the full rights as other people still want to fully participate and risk their lives. And you could argue made things better. Whereas today in the 21st century, I would say the pendulum has swung to if a group perceives they're not getting their full rights, then boycotts are more common, where activists have a better sense of what are the pressure points for governments or corporations that we can do certain things, we can have boycotts, we can organize in a certain way to achieve the ends rather than to achieve our ends outside of the system rather than within the system. And you look at both outside the system and in within the system in your book. And do you have a sense of, I don't know, what are the strengths and weaknesses of both sides since this is something that's been with America forever?
Yeah, so it's interesting. And I think what you described is exactly right, exactly what happened, at least in the context of the Japanese Americans. At the time it happened, those guys who joined the the 442nd, they were in fact perceived as heroes when they came home, although it didn't really change the circumstances of the Japanese American people. It did earn them a lot of respect. And over a period of many years, as they won medals for what they had done in Europe and rose to political prominence, particularly in Hawaii, it really did, fighting in the war actually did pay off for them in those terms. And the stories of the resistors, until very recently, were ignored or even suppressed, both within the Japanese American community and also in the larger culture. Nobody particularly wanted to hear about conscientious objectors or young men who had simply refused to fight because their families were incarcerated. Those stories were almost taboo. But the pendulum, as you say, the pendulum has shifted and swung back. And now there's much more celebrating of those who resisted and who stood up against the injustices that they and their families faced during the war than was the case actually during the war. So, you know, it's hard to say which is more effective. The way I see it is these young men, these young Nisei men, faced with an almost impossible dilemma after Pearl Harbor. And some chose to fight and some chose to go to jail by refusing either to be incarcerated or to serve. I see that as two faces of bravery. They had to do something, and the choice was hard. Some of them showed their bravery on the battlefield. Some of them showed their bravery by standing up, not only against the military and the government, but in many cases, against their own communities. Oftentimes, the parents and other people in the camps did not at all approve of the young men who refused to serve. So there was a lot of personal bravery involved on their part too. I think pendulum metaphor is exactly right. And as I say, in recent years, it swung back more towards the resistors.
Right. And as you mentioned, there's also a generational dynamic where their parents might not have grown up in the United States, but they did. So there's family loyalties that are to the nation. It's different from them. So I'm sure there's a lot of dynamics happening. For the research you did for this book, what sort of research did you do? And were there any surprises that came out while you were researching? Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Yeah, so my research consisted initially of listening to watching hundreds of hours of recorded oral histories. I listened to hundreds of hours of oral histories, trying to find the right set of three or four characters, people whose lives I could follow that would tell the larger story. And so I listened to and learned the stories of many, many more young men and their families than actually show up in the book. So that took probably a year. At the same time, you know, I was doing traditional research. I was reading books about the 442nd, about the war, about the camps, and that sort of thing. Then I began to meet with the families of the four individuals that I had decided to write about. And I was very encouraged by that. The families were very enthusiastic about this, and they pulled out diaries and letters and photographs, and all that became an important part of what I could work with. I traveled to Italy. I went on a battlefield tour with some of the sons and daughters of some of these guys, visiting the places where their fathers, or in a few cases, their grandfathers had fought. And so I got some, you know, firsthand feel for the countryside. So all those kinds of things. And then, of course, many hours also of archive research, sitting in archives, mostly at the University of Hawaii in Honolulu, poring over microfilm copies of letters and documents that shed more light on the story. So really a blending of different kinds of research, a lot of research, though, I'd say about 3 years of research.
Well, as we discussed, there are themes in here that are specific to the time in which they take place, but also universal. And for people who read your book, what are some takeaways that you hope they'll get?
Yeah, you know, I think particularly in this moment we're in this country with so much anti-Asian violence and rhetoric, I think one thing is just, I would almost defy anybody to read the stories of these four men, and particularly their families and what their parents went through as immigrants, and see what all these people contributed to American society, who wouldn't be moved by these stories and the sacrifices that people made. So I think the immigrant experience, and I think many people could probably tie that to their own grandparents or whatever experience, whether they're Swedish or German or Italian or whatever. These are common threads in American history, this immigration story and sacrifice. But there's some other universal themes too. As I say, I think there's different kinds of courage. And I think the book is partly an exploration of what that looks like. There's a theme that actually played out in The Boys in the Boat that is also at play here, which is sort of the redeeming power of, in this case, again, it happens to be young men, obviously it could be young women just as well, or anybody, but the redeeming power of learning to pull together and getting things done in groups that are working cooperatively. And then a theme that may not be apparent immediately, but I think is actually part of what's at the heart of this book, is the extraordinary importance of home to human beings. These are people, first of all, the immigrant generation who left their homes in Japan and struggled to create new homes in Hawaii or on the mainland of the United States. Then they had those homes literally taken away from them. Then they had to try to make some kind of home in these bleak camps in the American deserts. Their sons had to go off to war and fight their way through battles in order to come home. And then finally, when the camps were finally shut down and people were allowed to come back to the West Coast, most of them found that the homes they had created had been shattered and they had to start all over in creating homes. So this is a deeply heartfelt thing for people, this importance of home, how much we care about home and what we will do to have a home and to regain home. So I see that as sort of this big underlying theme that helps hold this story together.
All right. Well, for listeners who want to get way more into the story, and there's a lot more to get into, the book is Facing the Mountain, a true story of Japanese American heroes in World War II. Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly. including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.